Hi, Mark.
Hi, Rayhan. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm Rayhan Salam of the Atlantic and the New America Foundation, and I'm here with Mark Schmidt, the editor of the American Prospect.
Right, and also slightly of the New America Foundation.
Mark Schmidt is a man of many affiliations, and also a long and checkered history.
No, I realized that in Washington, you know, if you don't have multiple titles, you're nobody. You have to have. And it could be places that they haven't seen you in years, but, you know, you're some kind of vague senior associate research fellow or something like that. If you don't have a few things like that.
I actually am secretary treasurer of the Mark Schmidt Society as well.
No, that's not it at all. Secretary treasurer doesn't. There's only two things you could be, like, of counsel at a law firm, which is like you don't do any work, but you're at a law firm. You could be some sort of fellow somewhere. Those are probably the main things that you want to be.
It's a very darkly cynical view of the world, Mark.
And plus have like some kind of hedge fund that you're an advisor to. That you get I guess that racket doesn't exist anymore, but you definitely need a few things like that.
You do wonder about that. I mean, I was talking to someone, actually I can't use any names, I guess, but about a young woman who was the daughter of someone who was closely associated with a notorious Ponzi scheme, impresario. And, a young woman who, grew up pretty privileged and with a very kind of, healthy sense of the world's possibilities, et cetera. And you have to wonder about how she's thinking about the world now. And I have an instinctive sympathy for her. I mean, it's the world must look very, very different now. And I don't know.
More sympathy than somebody who didn't grow up with all those assumptions.
It's loss aversion. You know what I mean? It's like, you grow up in a slum. I mean, it's the thing about people who grew up in Scottish council estates. Their lives are full of more despair than, Bombay slum dwellers. It's, very weird. Although, as a matter of public policy, I suppose I care more about the slum dwellers. But all the same, I mean, it is something that tugs at one's heartstrings.
Well, and also, there's two elements to that. There's this life I thought I was going to have doesn't exist anymore, and then there's the finding out my parent was sort of not all I thought they were.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, an incredibly negligent.
And I think those are two. Those are obviously two. One has a psychological, is a very different thing. I mean, I'm far more upset about the 86-year-old couple that's in the Times today.
Yeah.
That lost all their money with Madoff then.
Do you know anyone who invested with Madoff?
Well, all I know is, there's a foundation in New York, the Jet Foundation. I wrote a little blog post about this. Which was a wonderful foundation because they were one of the few, of the liberal foundations. They were one of a very few that did very, very creative and edgy stuff. They did a lot of work on criminal justice reform, and they did some work on political reform that was really nice because it kind of got beyond the sort of ordinary campaign finance reform kind of stuff. Very creative, lovely people, beautiful office in Soho. And they were funded by a couple that, they didn't have an endowment. The family put in money every year, which happens with some foundations, and it turned out this couple had all their money with Madoff, and they were completely wiped out. They couldn't even make their grants for the year that they'd already committed. So it was
really horrible.
Sad to see. But it wasn't. I mean, they were sort of a step removed from actually making the investment.
Yeah.
The shocking thing to me, I'm fascinated by this story, I have to say, with one of the most interesting aspects, and this wasn't sort of on our little agenda, but that's fine.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting aspects being just these people who presented themselves as investment geniuses who were doing nothing but just funneling their money to Madoff.
Yeah,
which
I remember.
Is sort of astonishing.
Yeah, totally. And then, kind of blaming it on other institutions for not doing their due diligence, despite the fact that they were, of course, receiving, hefty management fees.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's a film about this. I don't know if this is the parent of the person you were mentioning, but the guy who ran the, I think it was called Greenwich, one of those, Walter Noel, and there's a film, a documentary film about how they bought part of the island of Mystique, and apparently they come off very, very badly, but they come off as like these great investment geniuses. It's like what a ridiculous way to make a living.
Yeah, and also you just have to
money to somebody else.
the sense of being a fraud, I mean, that I think that, you know, kind of a lot of, you know, kind of bright people are plagued by. But, I mean, I think that it must have been particularly acute given that these people were, in fact, frauds. But, I mean,
no,
now
no,
at least they've
been relieved. The people who have the most sense that maybe I'm a fraud are usually the people who aren't. To really be a fraud, you really need to sort of find a way to not believe you are. You know, the people who get to Harvard or whatever and think, oh, my God, there must be some mistake that I've admitted, usually are probably the ones who should have been admitted.
I was thinking about this in the context of, I mean, I'm obsessed with these Gatsby-ish moments. Like, I remember after the 9/11 terror attacks, this is very morbid, but I remember talking to friends of mine who were talking about how, you know, for years, I mean, they're... you were going to hear stories, and we didn't, as it happens, but, you know, for years we're going to hear stories about people who will have reinvented themselves by claiming to have died or something like that, and then taking on new identities or something like that. And it's interesting, just the kind of the wipeout of these fortunes. I was actually talking to someone about, well, this is actually a somewhat sensitive subject, so again, no names, but someone who married for money and, you know, kind of wound up having a couple of kids to someone who was just a serious dud. And, as it happens, the money that was married into was all invested in Madoff.
Oh, my God.
So, I mean, you know, given that you've, made a fairly kind of hefty decision based on money, when it evaporates. I mean, you wonder, is there a kind of deeper affection that one discovers in the process, or just a terrible sense of having been wronged?
Right.
Or just general
reevaluation
of your life's
priorities. Have you bought the rights to make this movie? You'll decide later which path it takes. I mean, it's a beautiful plot. I mean, it's a great... Yeah. I mean, probably the movie's been made or the novel's been written, but, you know, where they discover their actual deeper love for one another.
Did you ever
I mean,
consider...
Actually, it's a plot of it's a Henry James plot, I suppose. Or,
Did you ever consider a career in the movies?
I thought you were going to ask me if I considered marrying for money.
No.
No, I didn't. No, I didn't. And I don't even watch many movies, so, you know, we can't even...
No, well, that's fair enough. I'm a great lover of the movies, particularly of animated movies, but that's neither here nor there. I recently saw Bolt, which I'm not sure if you took your daughter to see.
No.
But it was 3D, and it was really
I don't remember if
she
saw it or not. I can't remember. I don't think so.
So because you have a daughter, and because you're doing the really crucial and invaluable work of reproducing, I wanted to ask you a question, which is... You know, for conservatives, given that we're going to be out of power for perhaps a generation, maybe three, the one thought has been, well, we should engage in more utopian thinking. We should engage in broader thinking that goes beyond, you know, these very narrow political questions of what can we achieve in this, you know, kind of political context. But I wonder, you know, for you, what is your big think utopian hope for the world? I mean, a world, you know, kind of 4 to 8 years from now, the kind of world that you'd like your daughter to grow up.
Okay. Well, that's a lovely question to start with. And I have to say, it's an interesting question. I mean, I'm going to turn it on. You're as entitled to answer this as I am. It's an interesting question, and I think the reason, you know, when you suggested this question about 10 minutes ago, 10 minutes before we started talking. You know, it's a reminder that there really is still a bit of a crisis of ideas on the left, as much as there is on the right, and the crisis is actually that there aren't a lot of people who are able to talk in those terms. I mean, to some extent, Obama is, which is great, but we talk a lot about means, and we're not very clear about ends. So all the talk about the stimulus package and what it needs to be, and then we talk about, you know, the need to increase public investment, but the sense of we're not doing a very good job of getting at the sense of what is the society we want to live in after this. You know, I mean, it's great to recognize all the things that the New Deal did. The New Deal is a wonderful story. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of it's an interesting argument to have with those who think, well, you know, it didn't amount to that much, but it's not helpful in allowing you to say, what do we want this, you know, this country to look like in 2014 or so. So I think it's a really important challenge at this moment to make people be able to imagine that. Now, I'm not a utopian by nature at all. So I don't have a, you know, grand prosperity for all kind of vision, and that's not really how I tend to think about it. I do think it is it is an economy that has a much stronger sense of the importance of security and cooperation within it. You know, that embedded in all our economic institutions, whether they're public or private or a little bit of both, a sense that in order to take the chances that make a dynamic economy work, people need a platform of security underneath them that's not, you know, guaranteeing results for anybody, but the kind of protection that people need to be able to make chances, that they can't fall all the way to the bottom, which, you know, it's your agenda as much as it is mine. It's secure health care, and it's a kind of unemployment system that works for the kind of transitions that we have now. You know, real robust social insurance built in both to the public and private sector. And, you know, it's an international presence for the U.S. that finds that is not based on, you know, military metaphors about superiority or preeminence in the world, but on, you know, creating the structures that are able to deal with climate change or able to deal with international crises as they emerge, or able to deal with with human rights in a collaborative way, and you know, not overstating the potential for democracy and international cooperation, but are sufficient to deal with those crises, and then a basic structure that allows people to, you know, partly by providing that basis of security, allows people to kind of move up into the middle class and basically feel a certain amount of confidence about their ability to move forward. I don't think we're going to create a socialist paradise. I also don't think we're going to recreate the kind of fevered capitalism of the last 15 years, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Is that not utopian enough?
It's interesting. I mean, what do you think? Because so your daughter, she's going to be, you know, by the time she's entering the working world, say.
Right.
I mean, what do you think about? I feel like you're not as kind of alarmed, sort of as some people are, by the prospect of, you know, kind of radical genetic enhancements or stuff like this. But I mean, what are your anxieties about the kind of world and the kind of workplace environment, and also the kind of international picture that she's likely to encounter?
I think the anxiety. I mean, it's interesting. You know, I mean, I grew up in a world where, you know, your number one anxiety was nuclear war.
Yeah.
Right. Which so far has turned out to be no anxiety. You know, not actually the right. So that there was a sharp lesson in what you think you're anxious about may not be the thing that you're worried about. I think we're at a weird moment in our economic history. I mean, I've never thought of terrorism as an existential fear that any of us. I mean, it's an important. We need to be prepared for terrorism, and we need to counter terrorism, and we need to challenge states that support terrorism. That's not the kind of existential fear that nuclear, that massive thermonuclear exchange was for somebody growing up in the 70s.
Yeah.
So it's a little different. There's no fixed international thing that I think this is the
So you have a level of humility about, like, what, you know, what exactly it is that's right. Going to be out there. Yeah.
Right. I guess in many ways I'm pretty optimistic about the kind of life that my daughter can have if we, you know, as long as we deal with things like climate change, and as long as we deal with things like creating an economic structure that basically works for people, you know. There are certain things that you see, you know, you can project them on a straight line and be anxious about them, you know. I mean, if the economics of college education keep going the way they were, my daughter's not going to be able to afford to go to college. But you know what? That's not really sustainable. Something will happen.
Yeah, one thing that... One thing that I wanted to ask you, and I do actually want to kind of riff on this utopian theme myself a little bit, but first I want to ask you, you know, right now there's this incredibly exciting moment where lots of friends of mine, lots of friends of yours mm-hmm. are perhaps, you know, moving back to Washington, are, you know, kind of taking new positions in the new administration. And you, of course, you know, worked for Bill Bradley, who is someone who, you know, lots of people thought of as a future national leader, ran a very serious presidential campaign. And I want to know about that climate when, you know, you came into political work because, of course, you know, this was the era of the Reagan ascendancy. And I wonder if you have any words of caution that you want to give to people who are kind of entering the political fray now, or, you know, any broad thoughts about how this generation differs from yours.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not actually Reagan generation. I mean, I started working on the Hill first George Bush was president, and then shortly uh-huh. thereafter was the Clinton election. And I definitely remember, I definitely had a sense, although, you know, there was nothing, nothing in my experience. There was, you know, the last point where people, you know, flooded into Washington to idealistically work in government was, you know, I think the Kennedy administration. and on the other hand, in certain ways, the beginning of the Reagan administration in 1980, although obviously it was different. With different orientations, you get different kinds of people.
Jack Abramoff.
Yeah, good, and good or evil. I mean, the scale and enthusiasm about it is different. I do remember, and it's very interesting how different. I mean, I feel like yes, there are a lot of people who are utopian and, you know, for whom this is just an overwhelming experience, but. And the opportunities are extraordinary. It's really striking to me how different the culture is between now and 1993, when Clinton was elected, and there was a huge amount of, okay, we're back, we can run the world, we can fix everything, that which fed a certain, you know, a lot of the hubris that very quickly unraveled. But it was also a much weaker foundation than they realized. So I think there's a world of difference because I think Obama both has a much stronger foundation in his electoral majority, in his congressional majority, in the level of popular support that he has. But there is also, I mean, I just don't feel that kind of triumphalism that I remember from 1993. There's just like a kind of collective sense that the problems are really huge and difficult. And the price of screwing up is very high, and you know we need experience wherever we can find it, even at the price of ideological perfection. And obviously, I know some ideological perfections, but there's a very sort of sober and mature approach to political circumstances that I'm not sure we've ever really had at a time of political transition before.
I think that's right, and one thing that I've noticed, and maybe I'm wrong about this, because, you know, you're more of an insider, so perhaps you can shed some light on this for me, but one thing that I've been struck by
is... That's not true,
is,
but okay.
But it's the way
I'll make
that...
make something up, so that I'll expose myself as being not an insider, because that would be the worst outcome, but okay.
Well, but it's the way that, you know, organized labor, despite the fact that, you know, over the past decade, it's had, you know, kind of a dwindling slice of the workforce, it's nevertheless marshaled its intellectual resources far more effectively. You know, it seems to me. And, you know, if you look at, you know, Change to Win, and of course, you know, there are some structural changes there that I'd like to talk to you about.
Change to Win being the spin-off from the AFL from a couple
yeah,
of years
exactly.
ago.
Exactly. And, you know, they seem to have actually done a very, very good job of, you know, kind of taking their, you know, limited resources, but, you know, deploying them very effectively, both, you know, in the context of democratic politics, but also in the intellectual environment, in the sense of, you know, becoming part of this emerging progressive ecosystem in Washington that, you know, may or may not play a pretty significant role during the Obama years. But you know, tell me about, you know, kind of what's going on in the labor landscape now.
Well, you know, according to the Times today, there are some discussions about reuniting the AFL-CIO and Change to Win. Change to Win was a group of unions pretty much led by the Service Employees International Union and their leader, Andy Stern, who's certainly the most kind of visionary and intellectual and union leader, and the one who most deeply thinks about the integration of labor unions into a broader progressive politics, as opposed to others who sort of think they're sufficient upon them unto themselves, and they should just be listened to. They split a number of years ago, which was always a sort of weird split, which didn't always play out at the state level. So often they still work together and things like that. I often analogize it to the divorced couple that still sleeps together. And I think it had a little of that, and now they're talking about getting back together. And it's always been hard to really, if you ask, I'm not a labor insider at all, but even if you ask labor, I know people who are, and if you ask them the real reasons for the split, it's a lot of it's very complicated, it's personality. When the CIO was formed,
There was a real ideological thing,
and there were reasons why there was a dramatic difference between the trade unions of the AFL, the industrial unions, and the CIO. You can't quite pinpoint it with this split, so they may get back together. It's an interesting, you make an interesting case that the labor movement has been part of the progressive and intellectual infrastructure, and yes, to some extent that's true. Stern is a very, very important figure bridging between the labor world and a broader progressive world. SEIU is an incredibly important organization. It's one of the places people learn to be organizers, and because the walls around it are not as high, a lot of the labor world, either you're a union organizer or you're something, some other thing, a community organizer, and people don't go back and forth between those worlds, for example. Mm-hmm. SEIU, they often do. Just a very different role. On the other hand, you can also say, here we are, and doesn't look like the Employee Free Choice Act, which is labor's number one priority, and which they feel they're kind of entitled to, based on the money they raised, the organizing they put in place, so forth, is probably not a top-tier congressional priority this spring. And you already see some peeling off from some Democrats like Mark Pryor of Arkansas, who earlier had supported cloture on that bill, some peeling off maybe from Senator Spector, who was the only Republican who supported it, and not a strong indication that either Nancy Pelosi or the president are going to put a huge amount of political capital behind something, especially if it's not really winnable. So it's hard to really call labor kind of big winners at the moment.
Yeah.
And I think there's a reason for that. I think it's an interesting phenomenon, because it used to be labor could say, and it's true, labor can say, we put this many millions of dollars, this many people out there, we turn this many votes, we critical role in all elections at all levels. And all that's true. And it's even more, the raw numbers are more true than it was in the past. But with the rise of Obama's built-in organizing efforts, some of the other progressive so many other institutions that are out there, and other sources of money.
The party isn't beholden in any sense.
The party is not nearly as beholden to labor as it was in the past. So that to be able to just sort of make an interest group-based claim and say, we're critical to the Democratic Party, therefore we deserve this, is actually going to be a less powerful claim than it was in the past. The alternative claim, which is to sort of emphasize that, a slightly greater, a somewhat greater union penetration in the workforce, and a greater ability to organize unions in normal ways, through the consent of members, rather than through some of the political pressure efforts that have actually become the mainstay of union organizing. So it's kind of like the question of bottom-up organizing from the workers, or kind of top-down through political pressure, consumer boycotts, things like that, that the ability to have that kind of bottom-up organizing, is essential to the kind of social justice that progressives believe in. The latter claim isn't kind of getting through. And I think that's, in many ways, that's a kind of intellectual failing. Maybe it's a communication failing. There's a lot of people being paid to do communications for the labor movement, and somehow it's not... It's 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 certainly not getting through against the argument of about a secret ballot for union elections, which is a little misleading, and B can be there are ways to compromise so that you really expedite the election without eliminating the election. It's an interesting time for labor. I mean, I think labor has to find as vital as it is and as in many ways healthier than it was, it still faces the challenge of figuring out exactly what its role is in relation to the progressive political era.
I was talking to a friend of mine a little while ago who is a political organizer for the SEIU in a big American city. And,
you're not naming anything here. You can name a city.
This is in New York. Where we're both from. And he was talking about how, before the decision to kind of temporarily suspend the term limits to allow for, folks to run for a third term, there was this fairly big effort on the part of SEIU and a couple of other labor unions, 1199, et cetera, to involve itself in a couple of outer borough city council races so that they could, kind of encourage some candidates. And given the tiny amount of resources, these campaigns tend to be run on a shoestring. I mean, they could have made a very big difference. And, some of our viewers will be familiar with the Working Families Party and the success they've had in advancing their agenda, which is a kind
Working
of
Families
labor
Party
back.
Fan.
Yeah, I mean, and also New York State has a kind of funny system, which to me is should be protected by the Constitution, but apparently is not, which they're allowed to endorse any candidate they choose. So they tend to endorse Democratic candidates, but, when you get lots of votes on the Working Families line, that gives the Working Families organization more sway.
Right.
But he was talking to me about this, and I was thinking about that and about how, what if you had, on the other side, some coalition of ethnic entrepreneurs, for example, who wouldn't necessarily be aligned with the Republican Party, but would involve themselves in a kind of similar vein in outer borough city council races, that kind of thing. But that's secondary. But it did strike me as a kind of very smart way for the unions to leverage their limited resources, because, that's, of course, a kind of farm team, because, invariably, when you look at, congressional districts in these kind of monolithically democratic cities, they tend to come from these lower levels of government, and sort of cultivating that early on, getting your people in office, seems like a very smart thing to do, and I'm struck by how little of that there is these days. I mean, partly, I guess, as a function of the dismantling of the old, urban machines, et cetera. But, I mean, that seems like one place where they could do a lot of,
Well, I mean, I think they've probably done... I'm not a historian of the role of labor in politics. I think you would probably say that they've done more of that than they were doing 10 years ago, say.
Yeah.
And then an institution like the Working Families Party, which has a value because it's a party that is also, that is sort of half in, half out of the Democratic Party, and is able to kind of hold the party accountable, also serves as a kind of progressive coalition that allows the labor movement or whatever to sort of more efficiently get its hands on something like an outer borough city council race.
Yeah.
By doing it in collaboration with others. And, I think that's something that most liberals look at the right as having done a lot better.
One thing that's very interesting,
even with the, the only equivalent on the right of the mass of members represented by the labor movement is the religious right, but by coupling, the money here, the people power of the religious right, and other claims, the right was able to get at a fairly deep level of races rather than just, the 30 targeted congressional seats or whatever that they used to look at. So, I mean, there's clearly, when you build institutions like Working Families Party, you have much more ability to think about races like that that create the farm team and go deeper. And I think it's all going pretty well.
One thing that I find interesting about, that particular political environment is that, within the 1199s, et cetera, you have the situation where the bulk of the membership, you have people of, Caribbean origin, lots of Latino workers, et cetera, who tend to be very service-oriented. They tend to be interested in the labor union, less for ideological reasons and more in terms of, kind of what their, what they're delivering to them in a very tangible way. But then you also have this piece, you know, people like my friend who tend to have a more ideological inclination, tend to come from a different class background. And, you know, one might say that if you look at SEIU, you know, you definitely see that, or the leadership that changed to Wynn Union, you see more people who came out of the anti-war movement, the pro-choice movement, et cetera. And it's interesting the way that they seem to have threaded that needle pretty successfully, and you don't see any kind of intense antagonism there, which, you know, kind of something you saw earlier on in the history of the labor movement. And, you know, it's interesting, but, I mean, I wonder about, you know, what are the tensions that will emerge? Will any emerge? Are any of them going to be tensions that could be exploited by a center-right political coalition? And it's not obvious to me that, you know, they can be, but I certainly think it's something to keep an eye on. One kind of weird question I have for you. I was reading a biography of Walter Reuther a long time ago, and I remember, you know, they were talking about how the UAW, or the CIO, rather, was talking about forming a political party in Michigan. And, you know, kind of, you know, given sort of its size, given its influence, I mean, this was actually a pretty serious threat. What do you think of that as a counterfactual? I mean, you know, had this happened in, say, the 1950s, I mean, do you think this would have had a salutary effect on American political development? Let's say it actually had been a pretty decisive actor, you know, capable of winning a gubernatorial race in Michigan, something like that.
Right, right. And would have prevented us from the curse of the Romneys? I'm all for it.
Well, but just in the sense, I mean, do you think that actually more, you know, kind of progressive political organizing outside the context of the Democratic Party in that period, do you think that actually would have led to a stronger left over the longer term, or do you think that just would have been an eddy that would have later been absorbed without any great significance?
Well, I mean, I think the question is, I mean, we don't have an environment that's very we don't have a set of rules that are very conducive to the formation of new political parties. I mean, if you had a new, the idea of a labor party is a good idea. You know, as we touched on this before, the Working Families Party exists in New York, because New York is one of only six states where they can legally cross endorse. And there is a, you know, one thing that's powerful to realize is there was a specific reason why the laws were created that prohibit those parties from cross endorsing. Because otherwise, you know, you would have had a much stronger populist democratic coalition in the, particularly in the Midwest, upper Midwest, where they began to, where the move to ban those, the fusion parties began. Without that opportunity, we don't create new political parties. We create political parties that exist really on the margins, really as protests, whether it's libertarian, or Greens. They really operate on the margins. So there's two aspects to your question. One is, would you have wanted a labor party in the 50s? And I think the answer is probably, it's hard to imagine that amounting to more than, even in Michigan, either that becomes something that's absorbed into the Democratic Party, or it becomes a kind of minor outside thing. I mean, typically third parties emerge, they put their points on, and then those get absorbed into one of the major parties. Or B, do you want labor to be part of a broader progressive coalition? There's a history, you know, one version of the history of labor that I actually heard David Bonnier, former congressman from Michigan, and had been named as a candidate for labor secretary. You know, I heard him do this very well, and I think it's very accurate. One way of describing the history of progressive politics is to basically say, you know, for many decades, all through the civil rights era and into the 70s and so forth, labor was kind of carrying the freight of the entire progressive political world. I mean, it is really interesting. There's a great book about congressional, you know, kind of history of Congress called On Capitol Hill by Julian Zelizer of Princeton. And it was one of the things that was really revelatory to me about that book was the degree to which, you know, the key civil rights advocate, the key civil rights lobbyists, who in turn were the key lobbyists for changing the rules of Congress, because until you did that, you couldn't break the filibuster and so forth. Everything went not through a civil rights group. It was the AFL lobbyist. It was the labor lobbyist. I mean, they were carrying the whole thing, and they were completely at the center of this broader movement. And So some in Labour sort of say, you know, we've been at the center of this broader progressive movement, and we've been delivering for, you know, we've been delivering on things like civil rights and so forth for a long time. Now we really sort of need to focus on our own need, which is a greater ability to unionize through Employee Free Choice Act. And that's an interesting way to tell the story, so that I'm not sure it's healthy for, it would have been an alternative history if kind of Labour went off and said, we are kind of our own political zone outside of the kind of Democratic Liberal Party. So I don't know. If I were there, I would probably have been against it.
As the editor of a magazine of ideas, I mean, do you feel as though your role in this moment is to help forge consensus, or do you feel as though the prospect's role in the present environment is to actually offer trenchant criticisms from the outside? I mean, what do you think of as its central role?
Right. Well, we talk about that all the time, and different folks have different ideas about that. I'm not sure that the people watching Bloggy Heads really care about it. I think it has broader implications, certainly. I think our central role is kind of opening a window on these debates that we often only really understand after the fact. I mean, it's taken a long time to understand everything that went on around healthcare in the early Clinton administration and things like that. I think our highest obligation is to kind of draw out what those debates and discussions are, and let them play out a little bit. Letting them play out obviously helps forge some consensus. It helps people understand where other viewpoints are coming from. I don't think our role is to sort of be the Obama boosters like the Weekly Standard was when every headline was, is George Bush the greatest president ever? I think we sort of did that once and then we'll move on, although we're fundamental. Obviously, we share a worldview and are part of the same kind of political project. At the same time, I don't think, you want to be, we will definitely have plenty of things that kind of blast the administration on certain points from the left, but our purpose is not necessarily, hold them accountable.
Yeah.
To progressive ideas. Partly that's because I don't think that's what a magazine does. I think a magazine's independence and perspective is, the purpose is to help people understand things, not to, if you want to do advocacy, go form a, go have a rally.
Well, that makes sense.
What do you think it should be? What's the purpose of the Atlantic?
I guess the Atlantic, and it is somewhat broader than the... Well, broader is unfair, but I mean, it's kind of less focused.
You have more readers for your title.
I think that it's also, I have a lot of friends who work in the world of, writing words on paper. And it's interesting because, and who are, kind of work for glossy magazines. I know lots of people work for women's magazines and, blah, blah, blah. And it's interesting just the kind of shared questions and the shared anxieties about what happens next. And I have to say, I've always been, kind of incredibly optimistic about the prospects of, kind of a flourishing intellectual life. I think that, the United States is a very neat place to be in that regard. But I've got to say, and this goes back to our earlier utopian question. I kind of have these incredibly sharply contradictory thoughts about the kind of future of the media landscape, but also just about the future shape of the world, because, I see these incredibly persuasive arguments that Mexico, for example, will just kind of collapse in a kind of smoldering ruin, but also that, it'll become this incredibly, flourishing market democracy. I also, because my family's from Bangladesh, and there was an election in Bangladesh a little while ago that was mostly unremarked upon in the U.S. press, it was actually interesting. I was doing a little Nexus search on it, and it's striking how few articles of any kind of real moment that I encountered, and particularly in Britain, when you're looking at the comment pages, etc., you know, one thing that was interesting is that there was so much discussion of Gaza and the run-up to the attack, and we're not going to talk about Gaza, but it's interesting because given how large the Bangladeshi population is in Britain, and also how restive and how troubled it is in a lot of ways, and how, you know, kind of interconnected it is, and these kind of diaspora communities with what happens there, it is quite striking, and I don't want to say it's ignorance exactly, but, you know, to me, like, I think that, you know, from a kind of Bangladesh eye view of the world, you know, you see these incredibly fragile states. You know, and you hear talk of 35 million refugees from Bangladesh, which has a little over 150 million people going into India. In India, you have a year where, you know, kind of deaths from kind of insurgencies, you know, kind of military encounters, et cetera, you know, were in the range of like over 2,500 in 2008. And, you know, that kind of instability that coexists with, you know, relatively robust growth and things that we think of as positive that are kind of tied into, you know, kind of globalization, sort of, et cetera. Just the way that, like, the total chaos, you know, kind of touches and sort of, you know, rubs up against, you know, these things that we think of as actually good and salutary. And the ways in which when you look at U.S. society from a different angle, and you look at, you know, ethnic affiliations and the way that, you know, labor markets work in our big cities and stuff like that, and how similar we are in some respects, that's, I think, why I'm so much more optimistic than most people, just because I guess my expectations are so much lower of how well our institutions are supposed to work and stuff like that. So, right. You know, insofar as I have, you know,
so your utopia, yeah. Your utopian vision is, you know, better than Bangladesh?
Oh. Well, my utopian vision 20% is actually
better.
it's more like, I mean, I just sort of feel like things are going to have to get dazzlingly fantastic, or we're all doomed. You know what I mean? Like, I don't feel like there is any real alternative to things getting incredibly, incredibly good, meaning, like, you know, human-computer interaction is optimized in some way that we become dazzlingly more productive. You know what I mean?
No.
Or, like, we're all finished. Because, I mean, there are enough things that could lead to kind of just general riotous doom. you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I don't really. Because, I mean, you know, you talked about the UK. I mean, the worst case scenario for the United States is a kind of lingering economic and gloom that's sort of like post-war England,
which wasn't that,
you know,
bad.
Where it takes a while to get used to the fact that, you know, we don't actually play the role in the world that we used to, and that psychological issue is as difficult to deal with as the actual, you know, where the GDP is. But both of them are kind of stuck in neutral.
Well, I guess
that's
I'm thinking
perfectly,
more,
that's a perfectly,
you know,
sustainable,
like,
scenario.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
no, I agree with you. I think that is a kind of imaginable, realistic scenario. But I mean, I guess I'm thinking of.
I'm trying to pull you away from what you're thinking of, the robot face and all that stuff, and, you know.
Well, it's weird, because, but actually, like, I guess my point is that actually, I am actually very optimistic, because I don't think that we're going to slide into doom, but I think that, you know, the mechanisms by which we're not going to slide into doom are going to be things that are actually going to make our lives radically better.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, like, I think that, I just see that middle scenario that you described as not all that plausible, just because. Well, it's also like, you know, when you look at China, for example, the extreme vulnerabilities of that society, and,
right.
You know, just when we think of how, you know, darn the China, and it's kind of like, holy cow, no, I actually hope that this keeps going for an incredibly long time, because the alternatives are so much darker and worse.
Right.
That's
certainly
yeah.
true. That's certainly obviously true in the case of China, and I guess in certain ways the case of India and Bangladesh as well. It does lead you to be a little bit of a technology worship. I mean, if you can really do the post petroleum economy right, post carbon economy right, yeah, you can imagine a whole lot of things. And maybe my short sightedness in my initial response to your question was,
yeah,
you know, to look at it largely in terms of policies and the relationship between government and the economy, and, you know, how you're going to structure the economy and make the economy work, as opposed to the, you know, what are the things that really changed how the economy worked? was in fact technology.
This, I think, it reflects to some degree the short-sightedness of lots of folks in the libertarian right, because you know I think that when you look at human freedom as experienced by people versus you know the size of government, you know as a slice of GDP. I mean, you know, in Korea over the last 10 years, there's been an explosion of government as a slice of GDP, and you know, not to say that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I mean, on the other hand, can we safely say that there's a lot more freedom? You know, in contemporary South Korea, I think the answer is yes. Or if you look at Chile, for example, and that's, you know, again, that's no argument as to kind of, you know, these questions at the margin of how big government ought to be. But it's also just a question
size of government and personal freedom have no causal relationship.
Well, I mean, I think I think there's a little bit of a tighter relationship than you do, but I think that it's certainly not as tight as a lot of folks think. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, the thing that's interesting to me is the extreme unevenness of your experience of freedom, even, you know, kind of within a particular polity, which is why, I mean, I kind of increasingly think that, you know, just, you know, kind of looking at these things at an angle is more useful. Because, for example, you know, if you're living in East Berlin, you know, or you're a kind of inner city, you know, black youth, your experience of authority, I mean, East Berlin circa, you know, 1985, something like that, you know, your experience is very different from, you know, kind of a person who is living in essentially a law-free zone. I'm thinking of all the kind of, you know, upper middle class folks who smoke marijuana, you know, at age, you know, 45, something like that, in the privacy of their own homes, not doing anyone any harm. And the law never actually intrudes in their space, and they would be shocked if it ever did. And it's so interesting because, I mean, your kind of objective experience of, you know, kind of what the state is in the world is going to be different. So, of course, you know, your political worldview is going to be quite different. And yet, you know, somehow these people fit in the same coalitions and they kind of fit in the same kind of urban economies, and they're, like, mixing with and dealing with each other all the time. And
Wait a minute. Who mixes with who?
You know, the guy... Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Or,
yeah.
Mixes with who? The Berliner of 85?
No, like the 19-year-old, say, you know, who's hassled by the cops, you know, semi-regular basis.
That's right.
And, you know, and just, you know, the prospect of those two people, I mean, I was mugged recently. No. And, you know, it was interesting because I guess I couldn't get angry about it. I guess I was slightly angry about it.
Right.
But to me it was more
liberal. Right on. I talk to you, I'm like, I don't really know why this guy's a conservative. He's a very interesting guy, but come on over.
No.
If you don't get angry about being mugged, you're a liberal.
No. I was definitely angry about it in the sense that, you know, for example, if my mother were mugged or something like that, I would be absolutely furious.
You wouldn't blame society?
It's not about blaming society. It's actually more like a radically individual sort of look at it rather than the kind of lefty, you know, kind of iron cage of modernity. It's more like, I would love to have talked to this guy. I mean, you know, and just, you know, kind of, you know, what's going on? Because, you know, what's the process? And I think that actually that was a little bit of a, you know, conservative insight into thinking about, you know, kind of poverty and sort of the nexus between poverty and crime and stuff like this. You know, one that hasn't been emphasized enough, and fortunately one that's become a lot more pervasive. But, you know, it's looking at Edward Banfield and, you know, kind of sort of different time horizons, blah, blah, blah. So I can definitely give a kind of reactionary, you know, cast on that whole question.
Okay.
But, I mean, it's just interesting because it's like the way that violence intersects with your life during this discrete moment. You know what I mean? And most of the time it doesn't. And it's amazing that it's not because, you know, I was wearing a stupid hat and I was thinking, you know, if I saw someone wearing a stupid hat, I might want to, you know, sort of grab something from them too. And they're eating a delicious sandwich. You know what I mean? I mean, I like sandwiches. And why is it that I don't do that? Maybe I'll start. I probably shouldn't.
Well, you know why you don't do that.
Mark.
You could write a memoir about it. You know, do it and write a memoir about it. But you don't do it. Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this, but I have no idea where you're going with this.
Have you?
I thought I had responses along the way, but now I don't know. I'm sorry you were mugged. You should have stopped an interview.
No.
I think Studs Terkel interviewed a guy who broke into his house.
That's one of my favorite stories. Awesome.
I think that's you.
So, Mark, have you ever committed a crime?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Can you tell us about it? Has the statute of limitations passed?
Yeah, probably. I don't know. What's a crime? Downloaded illegal music?
Oh!
Would be be the 45-year-old pot smoker if I knew where to get it?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, good grief.
So do you think that doesn't really count, obviously, as a crime.
Do you think we're going to see any reform of our drug laws?
I'll tell you this. It will be very interesting. I think an untapped area for Obama to build on the potential for real bipartisan cooperation, which is not just the, like, we'll get Arlen Specter and Olympia Snow to vote for something. Something that's going to feel really bipartisan is in criminal justice reform.
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily starting with the crack, powder, cocaine distinction or some of those things on which Obama has been pretty outspoken, but is of less significance at the moment. But real reentry reform, real... I'll tell you, you know, I have like a little pet cause, which I was reminded of by the death of Senator Pell, Claiborne Pell of Rhode Island, who created the Pell Grants, and passed away last week at age 90. Little pet cause, which is the restoration of Pell Grants for prisoners. It was one of those things in the mania, the anti-crime, the lock-em-up, abolish parole mania of the early 90s was this thing of, you know, people who go to jail shouldn't be getting Pell Grants to go to college when kids can't afford college. And so forth. And obviously, there are two ways you can deal with that. One, you could make it easier for people who aren't in prison to go to college, and the other is the path they chose was to eliminate Pell Grants for prisoners, which wiped out instantly the entire structure of education for people incarcerated, which had a huge, measurable, serious
on recidivism
effect
sort of
on recidivism. I once taught one day of a class in the Bard College prison program, which is one of the ones that exists, and it's beautiful, and Ian Baruma taught in the same program, wrote a beautiful article about it. That's like a great, I could see a set of things like that actually really bringing together, you know, a broad range of some Republicans with liberal Democrats, and I think we could make some enormous progress on that. And I don't know if, you know, I think you might see the beginnings of some state by state drug law reform, and there is a sort of slow processing of the move from medical marijuana to a more general decriminalization. I think will be a very slow process. So it was interesting today. I saw that Sanjay Gupta, the potential nominee for Surgeon General, actually has a very idiosyncratic opposition to medical marijuana, which is unusual. Which is, you know, I just think it's basically bad for you. I think it's medically bad for you, which is unusual. I mean, most of the arguments are
gateway drug.
Drug creates, you know, feeds a culture of, you know, and they're not really. It's an implausible viewpoint. Maybe, I mean, I'm not a doctor. Maybe it has more to it. It's just a relatively short quote.
The smartest argument that I've seen is the Mark Klayman argument, which is that actually, you know, if you saw it become commercialized on a large scale, it actually could have really, really negative public health effects, and also its interaction with the obesity problem, et cetera. But he proposes that he suggests that you allow people to consume it if they grow it themselves, but to ban the kind of commercial sale. And that seems like an interesting compromise, because, I mean, it does continue to target the trafficking, et cetera.
Right.
But, of course, you know, the trafficking, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, it's also interesting in terms of what effect it would likely have on the security environment in Mexico, because so many of the traffickers, so many of the cartels, they actually rely on marijuana as a steady source of revenue.
Uh-huh.
They wouldn't be able to engage in the kind of large-scale criminal violence.
Yeah,
exactly. The other things are higher margin, but, I mean, they wouldn't have their businesses without the marijuana smuggling.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, it's really, boy, I mean, I really, I love Mexico. And I do feel for them in the whole, like, you know, so far from God, so close to the United States shtick. So, Mark, any kind of last thoughts about, you know, the world and your soul,
I don't
crime,
know.
Your crimes, et cetera?
I know, I have no thoughts about my crime. I have no crimes that I feel guilty about, believe me. I have non-crimes that I feel guilty and feel regret about, but definitely no crimes that I feel any regret about.
But that says more about your lack of capacity for guilt.
That's absolutely true. My Ponzi scheme, hey, those people, they should have known better than to invest with me. No, I have no thought. How about you? I haven't, you know, you're interviewing me here, and I need to turn the question over to you.
Well, I think that the RNC race has been...
No, your crimes.
Oh, my crimes. So many crimes. I feel like the end of the year is always a useful time to think about this. One of my crimes is probably excessive delight and mirth. Just in general. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, the world was crumbling, and yet somehow I remained in an actually pretty good mood, although I did have a kind of obvious gut level sympathy for people who were suffering and losing their jobs, etc. But I haven't been able to help just, you know, wanting to dance all the time. You know what I mean? I think maybe it's the extreme cold, and maybe it's a kind of counter-cyclical thing.
Yeah.
But I know it's a problem. So I do feel slightly guilty about that. Although I'm not a Catholic, as it happens.
Okay, well, I guess... I don't know, sort of... Optimism is no crime. Just do something about it. Do something to make the world better. That's all we ask. And then you can dance all you want. Pay your taxes on time, don't, you know, all that stuff.
Also, one thing that I'm excited about is I'm going to get glasses soon.
Oh, good.
So that'll be exciting.
Oh, then people will really think you're smart.
Well, I'm going for the Mark Schmidt look, so that's what I'm planning on telling
people. People are really going to, you know... We're going to think, you know...
Mark, thank you very much for joining me. I really appreciate
Lovely
it.
Lovely to talk to you, Ron. You've been a great host here. I'm going to put my glasses back on again and say you've been a fabulous host.
Hopefully I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, very well. Bye-bye.
Take it.